You're now listening to My Sunday Morning Tech, the show where we dive into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else in between to help you make sense of how it works around you from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. every Sunday. Want to take a trip through history's major events or explore interesting geographical features and even some interesting scientific developments? Well, join us on My Sunday Morning Take every Sunday morning from 5 a.m. to 7 a.m. where we look into everything history, everything geography, a little bit of science, and everything else to help you understand what is happening in the world.
Welcome, dear listeners. Good morning, good morning, good morning, wherever you find yourself. This is My Sunday Morning Take, specifically here on this not-so-cold-but-cold Sunday morning. I say not-so-cold-but-cold because, you know, this past 4-3 days has not seemed like it was playing up to the, the ambitions of winter to some extent. However, wherever you find yourself, I do hope that you are, you know, wrapped up warm, that you specifically, you know, just keeping your toes warm as well in the same regard. And obviously, joining me here on this morning's particular discussion as we look into an interesting conversation I've lined up specifically with regards to, it's an aspect in terms of, let me also put it in a particular context, which technically flowed in just from the previous particular, you know, subject matter you heard from Mr. Maponga, who just played before the particular break, before we crossed over. And the interesting thing, obviously, was that he was talking about the unique scenarios primarily around the world, but he was obviously focusing in that stage on Haiti, and the impact that the French and the Americans both had specifically on Haiti. And we are going to another particular Southern Hemisphere country specifically, who doesn't basically factor in or feature in as part of the Global South, but they are a major particular, if you look at economy-wise and economic particular presence and power, they themselves do count for something significant. And this country being Australia. Now, in preparation for today's particular discussion, I was technically never, just to concede this particular point, I was not going to focus anything about Australia until I came across this particular, in the one resource I have, I came across this particular book that was written in 2015 by this author, Irene Watson. Now, Watson herself is she's a legal scholar or a legal academic. She's primarily, you know, an academic that specializes particularly in laws and the likes. And she does this particular sort of like analysis of what kind of a legal system existed for the Aborigines or the, you know, the Indigenous Australians before the settler Australians showed up and before those settler Australians brought along with them the, you know, the European-based legal system, obviously that it today that governs in Australia. And it was such a interesting particular perspective and a subject matter to highlight, because it has been one of the particular things specifically, the, you know, what do they call that particular movement that has picked up just before COVID, or well, it's literally between in the 20 teens that this particular movement kicked up, the decolonization movement. But I personally have an issue with the movement, because the movement is dependent still upon very Western particular resources and very Western particular mechanisms. For example, rule of law. It's not that the decolonization exercise is primarily suggesting, listen, why don't we use elements from the particular legal system that was left here and we develop our own. Our own based upon the traditional, you know, the cultural and traditional laws that existed at one point or another point, you know, across the country. No. And it's also a scenario specifically of highlighting in terms of decolonization, you know what, do you need to drive a 4x4? Or is there a particularly self-induced, self-developed, self-maintained, self-sustained particular national transport system? That's not what the decolonization movement guys are looking at. They come to you and all they want to tell you is, listen, don't speak English or don't speak French. And then it just ends there. And then you sit there looking at them going like, what are you doing? Now, this is not what this lady, Irene Watson, this academic, this is not what she's basically advocating for as well. What she's primarily highlighting is the imposition of a legal system primarily that does not actually speak towards the particular beliefs and the particular, cultural identity of peoples that were in a place, in a territory, way before any particular other settlers came along. And she's obviously speaking about the Aboriginal communities of Australia and the Torres Strait Australian or Torres Strait Islanders, because these two territories, the greater territory of Australia, as well as the Torres Strait Island and Tasmania, form part of the particular jurisdiction of Australia, as you would understand Australia to be as a country. And the scenario of this also has been that, you know, the laws that these various particular territories that I just mentioned had, they seem to be something that clashes ultimately with what particular in terms of, you know, because obviously laws are also a scenario in terms of following certain cultural norms and the likes. Following certain particular traditions and particular, you know, and particular do's and don'ts that, you know, a specific group had at a time. Now, just to extract something from her particular work, and just to put the point in terms of what she's emphasizing, is that this particular book that she obviously wrote is the first to assess the legality and the impact of colonialization from the viewpoint of Aboriginal law rather from that of the dominant Western legal tradition. It begins by outlining the Aboriginal legal system as it was embedded in Aboriginal people's complex relationships with their ancestral land. Now, if you've ever wondered why that sounds a little bit similar to discussions regarding, you know, Namibia's particular genocide chapter, the colonial chapters of Namibia, and also, you know, highlighting and hinting towards systems pre these particular chapters, you get to understand, okay, there's a similarity discussion from what we've heard so far across the country. Being emphasized, being spoken by, being highlighted, being addressed, as well as also being dissected in many scenarios. Now, it is important to state at this particular time, dear listeners, that the legal systems obviously that you would also find in like Namibia and in South Africa, because Namibia literally derived its own system from South Africa. South Africa obviously had a lot of Dutch and British influence, and then also later on with nuances of French influences, specifically in their legal system. And yet, in both scenarios, in a way, to great length, you know, you can see that traditional laws are not accounted for and technically don't, you know, factor in. It's also one of the unique scenarios specifically where you would find the application of the Roman interpretations and legal terms being identified, quoted, cited, as well as also deployed in African countries, because Latin, unfortunately, is not indigenous to Africa. Yes. Back when the Romans existed, them and the Carthaginians, which today is modern-day Tunisia, as well as the ancient Egyptians at the time, yes, they did talk to each other, yes, they did trade with each other, yes, they did interact with each other, but Latin, specifically, was not indigenous, nor is it still indigenous to this continent. Now, there is, however, an interesting perspective that also emanates from the work that Watson did at back in 2015, or that of her work that was published back in 2015, is that she highlights this particular terminology, the raw law. You know, belief systems, legal systems that generate from those belief systems, pre-settler, you know, colonialism, or let me rather say pre-European colonialism, is a dimension specifically that she calls raw law, because it is that specific territory which has that specific kind of person or people living there that developed their own system. Their own system. Now, she cites this as a natural system of obligations and benefits flowing from Aboriginal ontology. Now, this obviously speaks towards how you need to look at the particular development, obviously, that stems from what happened, unfortunately, in Australia. And to emphasize the discussion specifically of, you know, what basically happened in Australia, we obviously have to focus on some of the key things that, you know, meaning the history of that country itself, and basically what some of these major events look like. So, for this morning's discussion, dear listeners, after introducing that small little, you know, sort of like foundation-laying aspect of our discussion for this morning, we will highlight primarily how peoples from an ancient, basically ancient background, because when they moved there, the Aboriginal peoples, remember this was a time when the continents were slightly closer to each other. This was also a time where they literally could walk to a place like Australia. This was also a particular time that they could settle down for long enough to be there. And this was also a particular time when specifically, they had the opportunity to develop their own cultural system, their own particular societies, and their own particular language in that regard, basically, as they found themselves being technically confined to that continent/island of Australia. Now, before we continue, dear listeners, we'll quickly take a short musical break. After the musical break, we'll head and come back into some of the particular interesting developments, primarily looking at the subject matter that plays into the particular, or that fits into the particular discussion that we started off with. And that primarily is colonialism and Australia. We'll be back right after this.
But I wanna try. There's this alien job, you and I, and it goes dancing by in the morning and in the night time. There's all these secrets that I can't keep. Like in my heart, there's that hotel suite, and you lived there so long. It's kinda strange now you're gone. I'm not sure if I should show you what I found. Has it gone for good, or is it coming back around? Isn't it hard to make up your mind when you lose it and your fuse is fireside? There's all those places we to go, and I suspect you already know, but that place on memory lane you like still looks the same, but something about it's changed. I'm not sure if I should show you what I found. Has it gone for good, or is it coming back around? Isn't it hard to make up your mind when you're losing?
Join us for the Ehangano Concert Volume 2 with Ali Tobias. Experience an unforgettable evening featuring songs from her latest album, A Bilo, performed live with the full band. Special guest appearances by Tate Buti, DA, Paige, and One Accord. All proceeds from the event will go towards supporting the Our Lady Orphanage. The event takes place on 4 July 2026 at the National Theatre of Namibia. Tickets are available on Web Tickets Namibia for $450. Don't miss this powerful night of music, inspiration, and giving back. Ehangano Concert Volume 2. See you there.
And your fuse is fire.
Now we come back there from the sound specifically of, what's her name? Bebe. And with the song Dancia Disco. Before that, you heard a little bit of the Arctic Monkeys with the song Fireside. And primarily, you're back here in my company here on this. In terms of, if you're thinking about in terms of World Cup, it's literally sort of like the end of the group stages. So, that's where we find ourselves specifically on this last Sunday as well of the month of June. Now, where we left ourselves, just before the particular musical break in terms of our bookmark that we placed imaginarily there in the particular discussion. Obviously looking at a discussion, a dimension of indigenous law, or technically what was before, you know, a colonial, a template was installed or applied, is that it gets us into, I'm trying to understand primarily what had happened, or what was in a particular scenario, in a particular country at a particular time. Now, one of the things primarily that stand out in the discussion we had just before the musical break about Australia, and specifically thinking in that way in terms of the idea that that the author, the academic author Irene Watson at the time had positioned, was specifically looking at the indigenous setup or template that would have been present before colonialism showed up in Australia, is something known as raw law, because it was a discussion specifically of indigenous legal system, or, you know, cultural legal / legal system that existed before this westernized system was introduced. Now, Australia in its own right as a country is technically known as the Commonwealth of Australia. In terms of a country, as an official label, it's known as the Commonwealth of Australia and was proclaimed such on the 1st of January 1901. So it's fairly old, specifically as, if you think about it, as a autonomously governing nation. And it consists of a federation of 6 self-governing former British colonies, meaning you had the, they call them now the, you know, states specifically in, on the country of Australia. You've got Western Australia, which is a state, with Perth as its administrative headquarters. You've got Queensland as a state. You've got Victoria as a state. You've got, what is the other one's name? What's the one in? You've got New South Wales as a state. Now, the funny thing about this is technically, prior to 1901, all of them were like self-governing, colonial territories, should I say. They weren't identified as one complete territory that was completely governed from one administrative capital. No, they each had their own administrative capitals, and each of these particular territories played their particular role in having their own governance structures adopted. So technically, by 1901, they were formally viewed, considered, and as well as also amalgamated into this one fixed national identity. But the human history specifically of this country is something that is actually way older, because it is estimated between 50 to 65,000 years ago, the first humans actually rocked up there, which were known as the Aboriginal Australians, and who still continue to be present in that scenario. Now, when primarily looking at artistic and cultural and, you know, religious behavior, as well as also their particular identities, the discussion is one that you have heard primarily in terms of, okay, you technically don't hear about the cultural nor the religious component sort of like fused together in an African context. Reason being is because primarily we are now fully behind Christianity as Africans, even though the particular faith is also something that, you know, you have to go great lengths at in terms of proving its particular sort of like indigeneity, primarily because the faith is something that had been used in and had been recorded specifically as being used to assist in the colonial setup throughout the global south, from South America to Africa and obviously to a place like Australia as well. Now, Aboriginal Australians were also people that basically settled throughout continental Australia and many nearby islands. This also includes the Torres Strait Islanders, who also arrived from what is known as Papua New Guinea. That's the other Guinea country that exists. This is the only one on the other side of the world in the Pacific Ocean. And we are talking about discussions of close to 2,500 years ago, just specifically for those islanders. However, for the Australians, it's between 50 to 65,000. We take a quick break and come back right after this.
Großartige Neuigkeiten. Imba ist jetzt noch besser geworden. Wir haben brandneue Funktionen hinzugefügt, um dein Erlebnis noch reibungsloser, schneller und leistungsstärker zu machen als je zuvor. Bereit, das volle Potenzial von Imba freizuschalten? Erhalte alle exklusiven Funktionen für nur 36 Namibia-Dollar pro Monat. Oder spare noch mehr mit unserem speziellen Abonnementplänen. 5% Rabatt bei einem 3-Monats-Abonnement, 10% Rabatt bei einem 6-Monats-Abonnement oder 25% Rabatt bei einem 12-Monats-Abonnement. Wähle den Plan, der am besten zu dir passt und genieße alles, was Imba zu bieten hat, zu einem unschlagbaren Preis. Imba, where the world congregates. Lade es herunter und abonniere noch heute.
So we come back there from that specific break, and you find yourself here on my Sunday morning take, dear listeners, when you're in my company from 5 a.m. to 6, not 6, to 7 a.m. So, getting us back into the particular talking point where we find ourselves, the first particular sort of like contact between indigenous Australians and Europeans was primarily when Dutch navigators explored the western and southern coasts in the 17th century and named the particular continent New Holland. Now, a particular sort of like merchant, kind of a merchant ship from Indonesia, specifically. Not specifically from Indonesia, but however from which is in close proximity to Australia, by the way. It's a specific kind of a merchant. They are known as the Macassan merchants. who visited Australia's northern coasts from 1720 and possibly earlier. And then in 1770, obviously the very famous James Cook, who charted the east coast of Australia and claimed it for Great Britain itself at that time. Now, he obviously returned to London with accounts favoring colonization at the place called Botany Bay. Now, this then obviously led to the first particular actual targeted colonial approach to Australia. When the first fleet of British ships arrived at Sydney Cove in January of 1788 and established a penal colony. Now, a penal colony, guys, is literally you are bringing a whole bunch of prisoners from your country along, and then you erect structures and a prison, and part of these structures include the prison, obviously. And you offload the human cargo. No, they are not slaves. They're technically convicts from British prisons in the UK. And you lock them up on this new particular territory. Now, you have to ask yourself, dear listeners, why would you ship away your convicts, those that technically cannot be reassimilated back into society after having been, what the Namibian Correctional Services wish to call a sort of like being reformed person or individual. Why would you ship this person to another country? Now, remember, do take this in consideration. This is at a time, obviously, where we don't have the same level of legal coverage to challenge such particular ideas. Where we obviously, at a time, many territories and countries did not exist in the global south as they do today. And also at a time, primarily, if you take a look at this particular perspective, remember this is 1788, you did not hear James Cook basically going and telling the British authorities, you know what, there are people who live there. He probably did see people live there, he probably just did not say, you know what, we need to respect their particular sort of like right to privacy and not do certain things. No. So a penal colony was established. A penal colony, just to explain to you, dear listeners, is a settlement used to exile prisoners and separate them from the general population by placing them in a remote location, often an island or a distant colonial territory. Now, there is one such movie I watched. At that time, I was not as aware of the phrase penal colony. It was a movie, who was the guy that played in the movie, though? You know, it's the only prison movie that I would technically endorse because it was, besides it obviously being highly, very violent if you think back on it. But it's an indication primarily where the premise is literally these exiled prisoners who all get trapped on an island. And they are basically self-governing themselves, all these convicts. And it literally leads to a particular scenario of all out, because the movie is technically a war movie. And it leads to an all out conflict specifically between the factions on the island. Now, what you have to identify from this is literally there's an island, the facts, there's an island, there's a whole bunch of convicts exiled to this island by administrative authorities, and none of them technically are from the island. Now, remember, in the broader landscape of things, as we have also particularly heard in conversations here across Namibia and across the world, and even what you heard just before I started the program from Mr. Maponga himself, was a discussion of looking at if you are taking there to a specific island and a particular territory, but it is being governed like a colonial territory with extraction and primarily a discussion of how you view yourself and as in terms of national identity and the likes. It obviously is a talking point that then asks the question, for example, like in the discussion of Haiti, does Haiti actually then have a right to be talking about ancestral land? Because the Haitians are technically West Africans that were taken there specifically to work, you know, plantations on that island. Because the overall indigenous population of the island of Hispaniola had been killed out. When you look at it in relation also to a discussion, for example, to like the Australians, the Aborigines, and the talking point that we started off from the get-go, which basically talks about ancestral land as a focal point, as an anchor, as a bedrock, as a foundation to start from, which then highlights the particular rights that emanate from the discussion. What are we looking at? Now, you can obviously see how the start with regards to a country like Australia or the territory of Australia basically started off from. Because you could immediately see that the initial idea primarily by the British at the time was, let's ban our undesirables to a territory. We don't care if there are people that live there. We don't care if they are indigenous to that territory. We just don't want our undesirables here with us. Let them become someone else's problem over there. Yes, dear listeners, this did happen during human history. Penal colonies did exist. Now, some of the particular, obviously, you know, further developments that then highlighted the first contacts between Europeans and the indigenous groups or the inhabitants of Australia also then led into the next particular century, where the British then established other colonies on the continent as well. And further European explorers then ventured further inwards, further into the interior of Australia. Now, this particular period saw a decline in the Aboriginal population and a disruption of their cultures due to introduced diseases, firstly, violent conflicts, and also dispossession of traditional lands. From 1871, the Torres Strait Islanders as well welcomed Christian missionaries. Well, I'll put the word welcome there as lightly as possible. But the islands were also later on annexed by Queensland, the territory that forms part of the Commonwealth of Australia. And thus, obviously, choosing to remain a part of Australia when Papua New Guinea gained independence from Australia 100 years later on. Now, what has also happened primarily in Australia has been also various kinds of, I won't call them industrious developments, primarily because a gold rush is not industrious. A gold rush is more like the worst kind of scramble for a resource that you technically, you know, would not want. So, gold rushes and agricultural industries brought prosperity to the certain parts of Australia. The transportation of British convicts to Australia was then later on phased out from 1840 to 1868, and the autonomous parliamentary democracies began to be established throughout the six British colonies from the mid-19th century. Now, the colonies then voted by referendum to unite in a federation in 1901, and modern Australia came into being. Australia, obviously participated in both world wars, the first and the second, and also then sought to become a long-standing ally of the United States through the Cold War, throughout the Cold War until the present. And trade with Asia obviously increased, as well as also that the post-war immigration programs received more than 7 million migrants from every continent. But this is obviously that the supported by the immigration of people from almost every country in the world since the end of the Second World War, the population of Australia had increased to more than 25.5 million people by 2021. Now, get this stark, what do I call this, percentage into your mind's eye. Out of that 25 million people, more than 30%, or at least 30% of the population of Australia had been born in other countries. I'll say it again. 30% or more of Australians today had been born in other countries. Now, this obviously makes a conversation regarding what we started off with in terms of looking at indigenous laws, indigenous, you know, values, and primarily the discussion of ancestral lands, how this primarily plays a particular role in looking at a system that was there versus a system that was later on brought and imported from somewhere else, primarily to come and govern you ultimately. But before we continue, dear listeners, we're going to take a short break, a short musical break once again, and we come back right after that, heading into the second half of this morning's program here on my Sunday Morning Take. And this is, well, a discussion, obviously, that we are looking into the scenario of indigenous laws and ancestral land.
Well, the streets have started burning. There's trouble in the towns. Guess the devil loves his playground, that's for sure. I too often see the world through a veil of tears. Well, to hell with my immunity, gonna hold you close till the shadows disappear.
We come back there from the sound specifically of, what's their name again? Tears for Fears with the song Rivers for Mercy. Before that, you heard a little bit of, the other band by the name of Future Islands with Deep in the Night. And that ultimately brings us into the second half of this morning's particular programming here on your number one talk radio station, that being my Sunday morning take. And obviously, if you've just woken up, good morning, good morning, good morning. I do hope that you've got something warm, you know, to consume on, obviously, and being warmly wrapped up, because primarily, I've just as a little bit of a side note from our discussion primarily about Australia and colonialism, I recently heard specifically that these clouds that we had, in the recent days, and this particular sort of like not cold but not warm weather, more like a cool, slightly, a slightly mellowish weather situation that we've been experiencing for the past 3.5 to 4 days, was literally caused because it just on the other side of the Awas Mountains, these mountains as you drive out to Rehoboth here 9 years southwards. Literally, it was raining over there in the Hartab region. And technically, whatever happened there couldn't get past the mountains coming this way. Besides, obviously, the cold air and the clouds, obviously. But it seemed like it, you know, a scenario in terms of something else was happening on the other side of these mountains versus what we've been experiencing this side of Windhoek. But it's not to say literally that, you know, in some cases, we don't always still get our rain technically from the east, but it's just that in this scenario, it looked a little bit weird, just, you know, in terms of the observation that I saw. However, getting us back on track specific to where we left off with the discussion just before the break. So we identified and we outlined specifically sort of like how you see modern Australia until today, and the particular argument, obviously, that we started off on in terms of the ancestral lands and indigenous rights discussion. This obviously speaks towards a key particular discussion that that in many scenarios, for example, like in the discussion from a localized in Namibia, and a local Namibian explainer, for example, brought that was developed obviously by the Legal Assistance Center here in Namibia, is that around the world, the ancestral lands of those who self-identify as indigenous persons form not only the basis of their existence as communities, but also the roots of their spiritual and cultural values. The same particular thing that we started off on at the start of this morning's discussion. Now, this cannot otherwise be protected and preserved. For centuries, indigenous persons and peoples everywhere have experienced dispossession, forced removals and discrimination. Specifically that, number one, in Namibia, land dispossession took place during the colonial era, when many indigenous peoples lost their land to European settlers. And secondly, the situation continues in post-independent Namibia, with specifically indigenous communities seeing their traditional lands increasingly being threatened, being encroached on, or being expropriated for the benefits of agriculture, mineral exploitations, and other economic activities. Now, there's a significant particular talking point that obviously throws into conflict the discussion that we have this morning. Said particular conflict point is one based upon, you know, you find these scenarios, this subject matter in what is now identified as countries under a UN identity system across the world. You now see that this is a discussion because at the UN level, they also have to talk about the rights of indigenous peoples and, you know, peoples that have been living there. For example, like in the American context, they call them, Native Americans for, you know, identification from other Americans. But there's also another label that was used a little bit earlier. The last time I heard about this label was literally 2 years ago. It's known as First Nations People, which basically highlights that there was a society, governance, culture, and potentially legal systems. It doesn't look the same way in terms of that you needed to be in paper format and written a specific language or standardized language somewhere. But these things existed. Same to also in Namibia, those same things particularly existed. Now this makes things tricky. Because I can't say problematic, because you'll have to show and highlight the problematic scenario currently today. I say tricky because the discussion obviously then looks at a notion of various legalities, as well as also various rights, and potentially what obligations exist. Now, here is a problematic scenario specifically to start off with. For example, much of the legal systems that much of the Global South has adopted from their former colonial masters are legal systems, obviously, that still have laws present, active even up until day in 2026, that technically go against or have some format of unconstitutionality in the current constitution discussion. But remember, these laws existed when there was no constitution. These laws existed, they were brought and developed specifically for the particular territory at hand. Now, continuing on specifically where we left off, however, indigenous communities have not been submissive, specifically in terms of these various developments that are taking place in the face of these threats to their lands. Over the last few decades, such communities around the world have approached courts to assert their rights over what they consider to be their ancestral lands. Cases such as the Mabo in Australia, which is one particular key thing, the Delgamuuk in Canada, and the Adong in Malaysia, as well as also the Richtersveld communities in South Africa. That's specifically where I can't say my dad is technically from Richtersveld because he's more from the Oukiep area on the other side of Springbok. But the Richtersveld guys are technically the guys that literally, what we call small-scale miners here in Namibia, these guys are literally mining diamonds along the Orange River in South Africa. So if you drive just across the bridge, across the Orange River, into South Africa, that technically is the Richtersveld zone. And they technically achieved this particular goal of ancestral land rights, not just to the land, but also to the minerals of the land. Now, there's also the Endorios or Endorosh and Ogeik in Kenya, who have established case law precedents in support of indigenous peoples' land rights. On top of this, under international law, two key instruments have seen the light of the last few decades, namely the United Nations Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, which is UNDRIP, that's at the UN level. Back in 2007, and the Indigenous and Tribal Peoples Convention of 1989, or number 169 of the International Labour Convention 169. Now, Namibia has ratified UNDRIP, meaning we agree in principle with UNDRIP, but not with the ILO Convention 169. Now, primarily, when we've got to look at these particular discussions, obviously, it's obviously one based upon in terms of rights to living in, let's rather say, in dignified scenarios within a country, even if you're, you know, if you're part of the indigenous, what's his name? This indigenous people's particular landscape and aspects. However, the LAC identified in the same particular literature source that I've got here in front of me that while international laws ratified by the Namibian government place a duty on Namibian courts to enforce them when and where appropriate, a significant challenge in litigating ancestral land rights claims in Namibia is the fact that there is no national statutory framework supporting such claims. Locally, there isn't a system, or there isn't a template, or there isn't something that supports what the Namibian government went and ratified on. Now, this makes things obviously tricky. It makes it tricky because you also don't know primarily to what extent conversations as well as also then potential litigation or potential lawsuits, how long they would go on or continue on. And primarily against who, which is one of the most and key aims. Now, I like, for example, a little bit earlier in this year, the HACOM association, not the HACOM traditional authority, the association decided to basically, you know, register a court case against the Namibian government, which in terms of strategy, if you look at things in terms of strategy, is also primarily something that the affected groups from Namibia's genocide, specifically those on the aspect of the written execution orders or extermination orders, so that means the Nama and the Ovarero groups, their primary target should technically have been the Namibian government in terms of litigation as well. Because this is actually what the HACOM are also doing. Because remember, if you put down an ancestral land rights discussion, and since we're now talking about what rights the current legal system has to empower everybody on in terms of, you know, restitution, in terms of reimbursement, in terms of reparations. Namibia's legal system obviously does make provision for trying to compensate someone who was wronged, someone who was impacted negatively through violence and through dispossession by whichever perpetrator, and thus effectively order said perpetrator to compensate or to make amends. Now, and this is primarily a personal sort of like basically an opinion in terms of strategy, the legal strategy that should have been deployed, that I wanted, you know, these affected groups basically also to do, because the HACOM can do it because Etosha was established by the Germans. Etosha was established by the Germans, not by the Namibian government, but the HACOM are technically focusing on, that's now under this current particular sub judice court case still ongoing. They focused on the Namibian government. So, if you look at things primarily as they are, as a system, as they are, Namibia as a country came into being specifically because of the machinations of what was inherited. And for 100 years, that which had been inherited had still been maintained. So, who then, technically, in a way, is a culprit for maintaining a situation as it is? Unfortunately, it's the Namibian government. It's the Namibian government. They're the only culprit, specifically in this regard, and they're the only particular, you know, so-called entity that is aimed, that is allowed to engage with other countries and governments in terms of Namibia's own particular colonial past and history. This has been an argument that the German government has used since the New York court case where, before the Overero Paramount Chief passed away during 2020, and the leading NTLA Gaup, the chief, because both of them went to the same court case in New York and then had to fly back, and obviously flying back, both men obviously here in Namibia passed away from COVID. Same day, basically. And there was obviously a lot of noise being made, which I also couldn't understand in terms of, because, I mean, didn't people read the news primarily that, or not read the news, but hear specifically how COVID was passed on? It was literally because of airplanes, air travel, and the air conditioning in airplanes. I mean, I had a boss once who literally got pneumonia. And pneumonia in Afrikaans is known as longontsteking. Pneumonia is it's an infection of your lungs. So, and she got pneumonia flying to Spain because of the air conditioning in the plane, in the aeroplane. So, the unfortunate thing is obviously these two men passed away, primarily because this was during a particular time of COVID reaching its peaks in 2020. Fast forward, obviously, up until today. Now, the target under that particular discussion had been the German government, right? The German government taken to an American court, okay? Gets struck off from that role. The case gets thrown out. And so the engagements and discussions obviously happened still since then. The latest particular update, obviously, in that particular discussion being that President Nandi Ndaitwa earlier this year at her State of the Nation address highlighted primarily that the conversation, the discussion, the debates will reopen regarding the joint declaration, and that Namibia will reapproach Germany once again to change certain things within the joint declaration as well. Now, that primarily indicates, once again, which is one of the things that is annoying the impacted groups, is that it's the Namibian government who's taking the charge of the discussion, negotiating on behalf of the groups, which the groups don't want. There, I'm literally on the fence. I'm literally on the fence, because in one way or another, it's a discussion specifically about, okay, so if the Namibian government wants to play the lead role, then the Namibian government also has to bear a burden, a sense of responsibility. Now, I'm bringing you back to the HACOM discussion once again, which also factors in specifically about our starting premise from earlier today. Now, this means that all rights, all benefits, all burdens emanate from ancestral lands, right? Because all of this has to do, basically, with ancestral land discussions. Now, unfortunately, the Namibian government is maintaining and upholding a system that they inherited. I say unfortunately because they said yes to this particular thing. They said yes to it. They also cannot change it because, like I've told you guys many times before, there is a more powerful document in play in this Namibian economy than the constitution of this country. It's known as a title deed. It's known as a title deed. And as a government, it is not your role to technically wage war against your own citizens. So, first and foremost, you inherited a system, primarily, that already negates and does maintain imbalances, rather, that's not the correct word, but maintains a system of inconveniences. Because you have got inconveniences of people who know that they've been shortchanged because of colonialism. And on the other side, you've got a system of inconvenience, the other face of the system of inconveniences of people technically that can accumulate just more and more and more land, because primarily they were allowed to accumulate since Namibia's colonial period. So this means generationally they've just been acquiring more and more land. Now, when you obviously look at some of these particular talking points that emanate, some of these particular positions that I also highlight, and some of the particular thinking obviously that gets applied, because in many cases it's not outlandish, it's not sci-fi, it's not fiction-based discussions. These are talking points that emanate from human feelings associated to a resource. Human feelings, human disposition to a physical resource. And, for example, like what the Americans are trying to do under Donald Trump, where they are trying their best in terms of sort of like, I don't want to use the word, but I have to use it for just our discussion here. They're trying to purify the United States of undesirables. Now, throughout human history, specifically where you've had dictators in some way or another, such language has been troubling. Because in many cases, it speaks basically also to racist policies. Because you'll have to, when you ask the authorities, obviously in such a scenario, not our authorities, the American authorities, what do they mean by, you know, purification? I'm applying the word purification, but obviously when you've looked at the antics and the discussion since 2025, what has happened has been obviously the deportation of people, not even to their countries that they are from, to a totally, completely different country, as if they are a criminal. But then I also defend countries, because if you have immigration law, and there is a universal template of immigration law, being that you get a holiday visa, and the maximum amount you can stay on that one holiday visa is 90 days. And if you stay the full 90 days there, there's a set period of time that you cannot, when you fly out, when you depart from the country that you visited, you can't visit them for a specific period to try and come back. You won't be issued a new visa unless under certain specific conditions as well. I.e., it could probably be a work visa. It could probably be for like an event, if you know, that takes place there, or whatever you think about it. Specifically, it has to be sort of like an exempting aspect in terms of that you probably are invited or need to be there or will have to go there in some scenario capacity that basically speaks about you doing something there. However, bringing you back to the scenario of ancestral lands and the powers that obviously indigenous communities around the world extrapolate in terms of that the land represents their identity, represents them, represents who they are and their particular customs and so on. This is now a universally accepted position. Well, to be honest, there is a template that exists. If you hear of the name France, you immediately think of the language French. And that there's only one France and not a duplication of France anywhere else. If you hear the English language, in many cases, some people would think about America, but those who are slightly older and would know the difference that technically American English comes from British English. That is an identity I'm describing to you. It's a national identity, which is indigenous to the island clusters or the island cluster of the United Kingdom. French is indigenous to France. English is indigenous to England and the UK. Italian is indigenous to Italy. And German is indigenous to two countries, Germany and Austria. Russian is indigenous to Russia. Now, as you can obviously see there, countries that have existed for thousands of years in human history have an identity tied to the land. Tied to their land. It's the exact same thing, guys. It's the exact same position. It's the exact same concept. And it's the exact same indicator. If you think about Italians, and if I tell you, what is the first identity, what's the first thing, the first few images that comes to your mind when I tell you, think about Italy, or think about Italian? Firstly, you're imagining a person speaking Italian. Then you would be thinking about a standard template of what a potential Italian would look like, whether it be a man or a woman. And the third thing on top of that is that you would immediately think about the landmass of Italy. Where is Italy in Europe? Those would be the things that you'd be thinking about, which basically speaks to indigeneity, which basically speaks to cultures, norms, laws, developments is emanating from that outcropping of a country, basically from in southern Europe in the Mediterranean Sea. But before we continue, guys, we're quickly going to take a short musical break, and we come back right after that.
Right now, someone is praying for patience and lives we've missed. There's a line to be drawn between endless and infinite. What kind of love is this? Cry heaven. Cry heaven. Right now, someone is echoing the silence. Right now, someone is waiting for another pin to drop. Skin and
Now coming back there from the sounds of Richard Ashcroft with the song Oh L'Amour, and primarily bring us about 15 minutes out from the top of the hour at 7 a.m. primarily as we roll out towards the end of this morning's program. And if you've just woken up, good morning once again, but you're slightly late, obviously. But where we ended off primarily is how we've got to look at the particular discussion around indigenous lands, ancestral lands, indigenous rights from these ancestral lands, and the particular developments possibly that will emanate from this. Now, just as a disclaimer, we still first have to see primarily in a Namibian context where the joint declaration engagement will lead from this, or will take what steps will emanate from this. On the aspect primarily of identifying when, well, we will have to wait for the parliamentary discussions to commence or to get into that phase to start talking about it. Another takeaway from what you need to identify is time frame. How long possibly could it take? Well, it might take another 5 years. And it could probably be slower than envisaged. And then ultimately, it's also a scenario of then identifying, you know, what does this set a precedent for? How often will this happen? Will there be other groups coming forward, doing something similar, telling the government, listen, you have to represent our rights as well. They were wronged. Do your part. Play your part. So it primarily would lead to that particular possible position that I can see. That's a possible, the most positive, ideal position. Ideal for many stakeholders, which would also include the government. Even though I just told you a little while back that literally it's a smart thing specifically that the HACOM Association did by basically taking the government to court regarding Etosha, and basically telling them, hey, listen, this is that we are doing this because of XYZ or particular reasons XYZ. So, yeah. On a indications primarily in terms of how these particular developments then obviously pan out across the world is that there have been precedents, but remember they've got their own legal systems in that scenario, and primarily Namibia has its own particular manner in which to follow things. It's not to say because a particular development was reached which looks positive, for example, let's say in the United States, it's something that can be adopted here. Firstly, you'll have to look for the common thread in terms of how does said particular adoption take place, possibly. And finally, how do you maintain or try to keep everybody happy in the same particular equation, in the same particular talking or national discourse discussion or national discourse element. One of the key things, just to add in here, has been that for example, like in Namibia's context, the government's aversion to adopting a national policy and legislative framework for addressing the question of ancestral land rights restitution in the country has been ongoing since 1991, literally since independence. And this means a year after it. And this is even with the government who has held two national land conferences in terms of land reform processes. The conference was basically intended to provide broad public input for the formulation of a land policy. However, it was not binding on the government, and in total, 24 recommendations in the form of consensus resolutions were adopted at the conference. And despite being non-binding, the resolutions still influenced government land policy in the early years of independence. One of the conference resolutions was that the restitution of ancestral land rights was impossible under the conditions that existed at independence. And as a result, land reform legislation that followed, such as the Agricultural Commercial Land Reform Act of 6 of 1995 and the Communal Land Reform Act of 2002, is silent on the restitution on ancestral land rights. I'm letting that sink in, just so that you know. I'm letting that sink in so that you understand, primarily. It was a conversation. It was a position. And we are still at an impasse. It won't go anywhere quickly. It also won't fall away quickly. But primarily, it's just being kept there in order to not rock the boat. Now, on that note, dear listeners, it does bring us up to the end of the discussion. However, I'll be crossing into a short musical break that technically will take us to the top of the hour, because we're literally like in the last 10 minutes of this morning's program. And at the top of the hour, we'll be saying our goodbyes. However, we're heading over back into the musical break as we speak. We'll be right back.
so well. How do we even begin to explain ourselves? Moments we swore on our lives that we won't forget. Number one, you are the reason that I'm holding on, 'cause you're my number one. I'm away from this whole crowd when new waves come and tides move on. Every day you'll ever know is followed by a brand new song. Hey, hey.
At my age, you start appreciating things you might have taken for granted before, like good health. I've known from early on that donating blood regularly was indeed good for my health. I'm too old now, but I've done my part in saving hundreds of lives while benefiting my own. You see, my risk of a heart attack, stroke, and cancer was always low, because I donated blood.
Call NHP on 061-285-5400. We're about you.
Looking much the same, and it's no surprise that I don't want to listen too much. How can I give up on all the days I know I've won? There's nothing but rainbows. I believe in the shadows behind me. Thought I might be dropping out, but now I'm gonna work it out. With me, I'm running like an Appaloosa, then I'm rolling like a rusty ship on a stormy sea. You know the people are saying strange things. Talk to the head, 'cause I know you think the face is gone. I don't wanna listen too much. I'm not gonna give up on all the days I know I've won. There's nothing but blue sky. There's nothing but blue sky. Nothing's gonna stop me now. I'm skimming like a skipping stone on a silver lake. Perfect happy clown, you gotta make a mistake. And people are saying strange things, and I don't wanna listen too much, yeah. Not about the blue sky. Yeah.
Control.